The State Tribal Relations Committee is temporarily suspended by the state legislature. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Wednesday, June 9th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, what we know and what we don't know about the turmoil in the Tribal Relations Committee. The Dakota Political Junkies join us for that and for a look at the search for a new communications director for Governor Noem. We remember the Rapid City flood of 1972 with thoughts from the city's mayor at the time, Don Barnett. Summer road trips are about the journey as well as the destination. We talk safety tips to help you arrive alive, plus music to build community. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio inside SDPB Sioux Falls Studio. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Farmer groups are considering their role in reducing carbon emissions, and that includes the possibility of carbon banking. SDPB's Laura Johnson has more.
U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson met with the American Soybean Association and the South Dakota Corn Growers Association. The conversation included carbon banking. That's a Biden administration proposal intended to reduce carbon emissions. Companies involved in polluting industries could buy credits from farmers engaged in environmentally friendly carbon trapping practices. Kevin Scott is the president of the American Soybean Association. He's open to the concept as long as it's voluntary.
We think there's great opportunity to store more carbon in South Dakota. Some of our presenters today have said we're in a great position because we're increasing our row crop production with lower tillage, reducing water use, increasing the products we're producing there. So a great opportunity for South Dakota to grow in that carbon bank situation.
Scott encourages farmers to understand any contracts involving carbon banking. He says a single program from carbon banking is not possible because farms vary in practices and soil nutrients. Congressman Johnson says he wants to make sure sustainable practices are accessible and affordable to farmers.
And really, goal number one for us should be make sure that we have a regime where producers can capture the bulk of the value for their conservation practices.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has not yet rolled out a carbon bank program. The department secretary says it would involve congressional funding. For SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson.
The Black Hills Community Theater is back this summer after the pandemic shut down last year's performances. The season will open with an adaptation of Sense and Sensibility and close with Charlotte's Web. Merlin Sell is the education assistant for the company. She will also direct Sense and Sensibility.
It's been a very joyful experience. It's just been so much fun to play together and be in the same space together.
They'll stage both plays on the lawn of the Performing Arts Center. Sell says it's a unique opportunity.
For actors who are mostly working indoors, it's a totally different set of muscles that you have to use and different challenges. So I think it's been a very exciting project for everybody.
All performances are free and open to the public. The audience is encouraged to bring chairs and blankets. The season opens June 11th and runs for 2 weekends. For weather today, it's sunny and hot. High temperatures are mainly in the 90s. The only exception is the Black Hills with highs in the lower 80s. We can expect the heat to cool down to the lower 60s west to the lower 70s in the east later tonight. As the sun sets, we're expecting increasing clouds west and mostly clear skies east. There's a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms expected in the northeast by the evening. That's going to look like possible pop-up showers. Strong to severe storms are expected to develop in the western Dakotas tomorrow evening, slowly weakening as they move east into early Friday morning. The National Weather Service reports damaging wind will be the primary threat if any severe storms remain as they push through eastern South Dakota. By tomorrow evening, we're expecting partly cloudy skies statewide. Again, there's the possibility of severe storms starting in the west around midnight. Those storms will move eastward during the overnight hours. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. On Tuesday, voters in Clay County rejected a $41 million bond that would have funded construction of a new courthouse, jail, and law enforcement center. Travis Mockler is the chair of the Clay County Commission and joins us now with an update. Commissioner Mockler, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about some of your early response to the defeat of this bond issue.
I really haven't had any responses. I've been busy today, so
I haven't talked
to anybody yet. I just know that.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, let's help. I think we should probably start with this for people across the state. What was the issue on the table? What's the problem with the current courthouse and jail? And what was the bond measure intended to do?
So with the jail issue, our jail is outdated and not up to code that is set by federal standards. So, and no matter what was going to happen, we have to close our jail. So we'll have to come up with a new plan on what we're going to do there. We're going to be looking at closing the jail quickly. And then the courthouse, it's a 109-year-old building. It needs updating. I mean, the plumbing is the original. The electrical is original. Heating and cooling is pretty much original. And we got looking into what it was going to cost to fix all that. And we came to the conclusion that it was cheaper to build new than to repair the old.
Yeah.
That's where we were at.
When you say close jail quickly, you mean weeks, days, months? What's quickly?
I'm assuming we have a meeting tomorrow with the commissioners. I'm assuming our sheriff will bring it to us, tell us that the plan he's working on. I know he's currently working on the plan of how it's going to work, of what we can and can't do. So, and that plan was in motion before the vote. Mm. I mean, it just had to happen. Because the jail is the original, it's the first floor of the original courthouse. So it's the one that they built 109 years ago.
Yeah. So voters rejected the bond issue, 1,544 against and 766 votes for. What kind of turnout is that? Did you think when you looked at the voter turnout that it was representative of the whole community, or did you struggle with that?
I think like every election, when it's not really an election year. I mean, we did have in Vermilion a mayor race and school board election, but when it's not U.S. representatives or senator or a presidential race, the voter turnout's really low. I think we averaged 25% last night, which is extremely low.
Mm-hmm.
So out of 8,000 registered voters, we got 2,000. 2,500.
Right.
So not a very good turnout.
What happens next?
I'd like to say that we could take a year off and regroup, but tomorrow morning we'll have to. I'm going to propose how to address the jail issue. That's our number one issue right now, because that is going to cost us a lot of money to house prisoners in a different county.
Yeah, explain that, because it's not as simple. I mean, there's immediate issues, and then there's a cost, cost benefit for having your own jail versus sending them. Explain to people what that means as far as transportation and housing people in other counties.
So how do I want to explain this? We can house 20 prisoners. I mean, that's maximum for Clay County. But on average, every month, we probably have another 5 in a different county. And we go anywhere from Union to Yankton, into Nebraska, Sioux City, Iowa, wherever we can find a spot, because jail cells are pretty limited commodity right now. We spend about $10,000 to $15,000 a month housing those 5 prisoners elsewhere. But if we close the jail, our sheriff he's run the numbers. He said over that 30-year period of what that bond was going to cost, if we were to house our prisoners outside of the county, we were going to spend almost $41 million housing them elsewhere. So we're still going to have to opt out just to pay that housing bill until we get something built. Mm. You know, and that's the sad part. We're still going to spend the money. It's just we're going to give it to somebody else in the short term until we get something figured out.
Yeah. So if it had passed, property taxes would have gone up $1.60 per $1,000 for for property owners in the state. And this is not a conversation that's over. Something really has to be done is what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem doesn't go away. It's not a, no, we're not going to spend any money type vote. And maybe we didn't do a good enough job getting that across, but we came up with what we thought was the cheapest option. So, but we're still gonna have to opt out and spend that money because it's not in the budget to house prisoners in another county. Not all of the prisoners. We just don't have $700,000-$800,000 a year right now laying around.
Yeah.
To house prisoners, so somebody's got to pay that bill.
Yeah. And your point earlier was that this is not up to code, so you can't just keep those prisoners where they're at. Something has to be done in the short term as well.
Yeah, we're trying to avoid a lawsuit.
Exactly. Travis Mockler is the...
That's our problem.
Yeah. Travis Mockler is the chair of the Clay County Commission. Thank you so much for being here with us today. We look forward to hearing more about this in the future.
Thank you.
Up next, South Dakota breaks the 50% plane for vaccine series completion, but we're nowhere near the 75% goal. SDPB's Laura Rohde talks with South Dakotans who have decided to not get the vaccine. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
More than a year ago, many Americans didn't think regularly working from home was even possible. Then the pandemic hit and everything changed.
What has been seen cannot be unseen.
I'm one that likes to keep work and home separate, but then I started relishing working from home.
The advantages and disadvantages of working remotely. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by TSP, an architectural, engineering, interior design, and planning firm rooted in and supporting communities across South Dakota. TSP's rich history provides the passion to make our communities better by design for another 90 years.
Join your friends and neighbors by keeping SDPB strong. Become a $10 a month sustaining member and gain access to SDPB Passport. It's an on-demand library of hundreds of PBS and South Dakota Public Broadcasting shows, your favorites on your time. Details at sdpb.org/passport.
Program funding by Denny Menhold Rapid Chevrolet in Rapid City, inviting you to experience the peace of mind and more that come with driving a certified vehicle from Denny Menhold Rapid Chevrolet. See you at Denny Menhold Rapid Chevrolet in Rapid City.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. As of today, 55% of South Dakotans have had at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, with just over 50% having completed the series now. To achieve safety from herd immunity, experts predict 75% need to be vaccinated. What will it take to convince those still not vaccinated to get the vaccine? To answer this question, SDPB's Laura Rohde asks two unvaccinated South Dakotans.
You know, I'm right. The way things are going now, I'm not sure anything could convince me.
Bill Slavik is a third-generation Phillips, South Dakota cattle rancher. And when it comes to herd health, Slavik is a believer in vaccines. But when it comes to his own health, he's a bit hesitant to rely on them, especially when it comes to COVID-19 vaccine.
You know, when we get a new drug in the cattle industry, the company that is bringing it up, invented it or whatever you want to call it, they probably take some 5 to 10 years to get FDA approval, and it costs them tens if not hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases. And sometimes when they get to the end, they don't get approved. And here we are talking about human vaccine, and we went from having our first case in January of 20, I think, to almost we're in no time at all we had vaccine. And I agree they did what they had to do, but I question that no more time than they had. We don't know what the side effects might be a year or 5 or 10 years later after the shot. So that's my concerns on the vaccine. And the second thing is having it, I feel like I have immunity, and nobody has convinced me yet that a vaccine will give me better immunity than having natural immunity.
Slavik's concerns are not unique. In fact, since the vaccines became available, Dr. David Basil, vice president of Avera Medical Group Clinical Quality, has heard similar concerns from many South Dakotans. When patients ask whether they should get the vaccine since they have already had COVID-19, Dr. Basil explains vaccines are directed specifically against the critical part of the virus, the spike protein, and the vaccine creates a higher concentration of antibodies against this part of the virus than natural immunity does. And when patients express that not enough research went into the COVID-19 vaccines, this is his response.
The way that happened with the COVID vaccines is the federal government said, we're going to do a gamble and we're going to put all kinds of money at the top 6 vaccine candidates, and hopefully some of them end up turning out to be safe and effective. And the ones that do, we'll then already have them in production so that we can hit the ground running. And so that's what they did. Even during, phase 2 studies, they were already ramping up their factories and equipment and supplies and everything, and already starting production before they had approval, so that if the vaccines did work out, that we'd be ready to go. And that turned out to be a great gamble, but those first 2 out of the gate been more safe and effective than any vaccine candidate we've ever had, at least during my lifetime. And so it's been a great gamble. So that's the major place where time was taken out of the system. And that took a good couple of years out of the system by doing that. And so the actual research side of it, the phase 2 studies, the phase 3 studies, look exactly like any other vaccine that came out. In fact, they're probably even larger than most vaccine studies that come out. So that's probably the number one thing that I point out. Another thing that I point out now is that, especially at this point of time, these, especially talking about the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, are now the most studied vaccines we've ever had, the most intensely studied. We've collected the most data on them.
To help listeners understand the significance of Dr. Basil's comment that the COVID-19 vaccines are the most studied vaccines in his lifetime, Dr. Basil is over 50 and has practiced medicine for more than 2 decades. In addition to being the most studied during development, Dr. Basil says the post-go-live data collection is also much greater. Like Bill Slavik, Morgan has not yet been vaccinated. This is probably where their similarities end.
So I am 22. I just graduated last December from USD with the Communication Studies and Media Journalism major. And I'm currently living at home. I'm actually moving to Limerick, Ireland here in August. So I'm at home kind of waiting for that to happen, doing some independently contracted caregiving just to make ends meet while I'm in the process of applying for a visa and getting ready to move.
The reason she has yet to get the vaccine is health-related, so we are only using Morgan's first name.
I guess I'm nervous about it. I have something called polycystic ovarian syndrome, and I have a really high chance of not being able to have kids because of this. And I think my biggest fear of all of the small ones I have is the vaccine possibly causing infertility or causing women to have more trouble with getting pregnant.
Her fears were validated when she began seeing posts in online platforms she frequents for women with polycystic ovarian syndrome. In a committed relationship with plans to get married to her boyfriend who lives in Ireland, Morgan explains that becoming a mom is something she really wants. Obstetrician and gynecologist Dr. Kimberly McKay says other patients have expressed this same concern. But when they ask for her advice, the clinical vice president says she encourages patients to get vaccinated because the CDC and the Society of Maternal-Fetal Medicine believe the vaccine is safe and does not negatively impact fertility. And Dr. McKay says if a pregnant woman or an individual with polycystic ovarian syndrome, or PCOS, gets COVID-19, the chances that the illness will be more severe are much greater. She references studies that even show COVID-19 to impact ovarian reserves.
COVID's really mean to pregnant women. Higher preterm birth rates, there's higher preeclampsia rates, higher rates of blood clots in moms. So it's like, this is a really nasty little virus to pregnant women.
Before airing this story, I shared the doctor's responses with Bill Slavik and Morgan to see if this information impacts their vaccination decisions. Here's what they have to say.
So I think I've decided to get vaccinated, and I've been thinking a lot about it since our initial interview. And I mean, I still have my concerns. I mean, reading what the doctor said definitely, I mean, puts things into a different perspective as well.
I'm just not dead set against it. If my local doctor said, Bill, you should get the shot, I'd probably do it. But I guess until I see a real need.
And at the moment, Slavik says concerns over whether or not to get the COVID-19 vaccine are not top of mind.
We're terrible dry out here. We were dry last fall, so we had no subsoil moisture, no topsoil moisture going into winter, very little snow, no rain yet this year. So we're really dry. So, and a month ago, we shipped out a bunch of cattle that we were going to normally put on grass.
When it comes to vaccine hesitancy, Dr. Basil also references drought conditions.
I describe it as we still got a lot of dry grass on the ground, and it's only going to take a couple sparks next fall to reignite some pockets of COVID if we don't get another, you know, good 15% of the population or so immunized. And so we've got to keep working to get that last 15%, or this won't be the last we hear of COVID.
If you are hesitant to get vaccinated because of concerns over vaccine safety, give your doctor a call. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Rohde.
You can find and share all our stories online at sdpb.org/news. Ahead on the program, the Dakota Political Junkies discuss Governor Noem's search for a new communications director. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
As a young, wealthy socialite, Cole Porter had the unusual goal of becoming a successful Broadway composer. By the 1930s, he was one of the major songwriters for the Broadway stage and was also composing for Hollywood musicals. Through the years, jazz musicians and vocalists have been inspired by Porter's melodies and witty lyrics. I'm Carl Gerke. Today is Porter's 130th birth anniversary, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll mark the occasion with some recent recordings of his songs. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
Program funding by ReliaBank, personal and business banking solutions, reliable services, and a friendly welcome at 9 locations across eastern South Dakota. ReliaBank, a brighter banking experience since 1920. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Miss something on SDPB? Sign up for the SDPB Morning Report. Get the reporting you love straight to your email twice a week. Go more in depth with our statewide coverage, and don't miss critical segments from shows like In the Moment and South Dakota Focus. It's the news you can use, free from clutter, and best of all, free of charge. To sign up for the Morning Report, visit sdpb.org/news and scroll to the bottom.
Program funding with your support and by Ingalls Homestead, Laura's Living Prairie. Sharing Laura Ingalls Wilder's pioneer heritage through covered wagon rides and hands-on activities. Online at IngallsHomestead.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Governor Kristi Noem is searching for a new communications director. The State Tribal Relations Committee is in flux, plus a shift in how the state reports COVID hospitalizations. The Dakota Political Junkies are comprised of a rotating panel of journalists, political scientists, and political leaders. Today, we welcome Jonathan Ellis, reporter and columnist for Argus Leader Media, and Mike Card, associate professor of political science at the University of South Dakota. Mike Card is joining us from SDPB Studios in Vermilion. Dr. Card, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
Jonathan Ellis is joining us on phone from Sioux Falls. Jonathan, hey.
Hey, happy to be with both of you.
So let's start with Jonathan here, because the Argus Leader front page story on how the state is sort of shifting hospitalization reporting, how that impacts the numbers and really what we're seeing overall. Jonathan, you've been tracking this data since the beginning. Give us an update.
Yeah, so I noticed last week while I was vacationing in beautiful Colorado that the number of hospitalizations were going down instead of up, and that's unusual, isn't it? So anyway, but what they've done now,
the ever hospitalized numbers,
hospitalized, mm-hmm. Correct? Yeah, and so so in just my inquiry with the Department of Health is that they are recategorizing people who I guess would have been qualified or would have been termed hospital care under previous reporting guidelines, now are not. And so and I think that what that does is that reflects, I think, a lot of early on in the pandemic, a lot of people were hospitalized that maybe wouldn't have been later. And you saw a big shift, especially in the fall. I think in the summer and fall, you saw a big shift to people being essentially given some type of hospitalized care, but not necessarily in a hospital setting. So you saw a greater use of oxygen levels for people who were suffering from the disease. And so I think part of the recategorization there is I guess to go back and look at like what was an actual hospital case. The result of that is, of course, then the case hospital rate has fallen. It was over 6%. It's fallen below that now. And then earlier in the pandemic, the hospitalization rate was closer to 10%. So that gives you kind of an idea of how hospitalizations changed over the course of the year during the pandemic.
What do you think is the intention of doing this? Is this because clearly the suspicious or skeptical among us is going to say, well, they're trying to sort of recreate a narrative after the fact that nobody can find, a path back into the reality of this, and other people are going to say, no, this is just the way. I mean, they've been adjusting the dashboard and how they, categorize things throughout this whole pandemic as we all sort of figured out what numbers matter and how they should be reported. What's your take on it?
Well, my take on it has been that by and large, the Department of Health has been fairly transparent with the data, and it has tried to provide more and more as things progressed. I mean, very early on, there was very little information of. And as they built these dashboards out, more and more information became available. I don't see how changing hospitalization criteria necessarily deviates from whatever narrative you want to take on this, because the data still exists. In terms of what was originally reported and what has been revised. And I think that what most people will be looking at, regardless of how they want to judge, if that's the intent is going to be looking at, per capita deaths.
Hmm. Mike Card, anything you want to add to this overall, where we're at in the pandemic right now, how we are kind of viewing it as we get to our next normal and recapping what we've been through from a data perspective?
I don't think I have much to add. I think Jonathan's right on target that the statistic that captures most people's attention is the per capita death rate. And what we don't have data on would involve the long haulers, the individuals who, after a month after being released from the hospital, can't walk from their house to the car, mm-hmm. without having to stop to rest. That this disease is a big mystery in terms of it affecting relatively few people, but if it affects you, it affects you greatly.
Yeah, and a friend who had to do a Kickstarter campaign to get a portable oxygen machine to help her navigate her long haul with COVID. And to Jonathan's point, too, those stories of hospital workers who created makeshift hospitals and nursing homes basically because the capacity was full. I mean, all those stories of people figuring out telehealth, and I mean, what an effort from healthcare providers across the state in small towns and large. So let's leave that there for now, because I want to go on to this idea of a new communications director after the departure of Maggie Seidel. Governor Noem is looking for someone new, and Mike Card, that involves an out-of-state search and, what, taxpayer dollars?
Well, of course, any search has a cost to it, whether it's in terms of the time of individuals seeking, interviewing, advertising, and reviewing candidates. There's a cost to turnover. You know, several years ago, I conducted a study of replacing bank tellers, and the cost in terms of lost productivity and in terms of the cost of people involved in interviewing bank tellers was about $7,000 per vacancy. Mm. So this is an extra cost because we're advertising out of state. Finding someone who has a similar political perspective as the governor, a similar managerial perspective as the governor, because this person will be directing the governor's communications, may cost more to find someone like that and to find someone with the professional qualifications.
Jonathan, this is not a civil service position, so some of the details of what they're looking for are not necessarily posted on the state website. Tell us how you look at this search for Maggie Seidel's replacement.
Well, you know, Maggie Seidel and then Ian Fury, who still is with the governor, I mean, they were not typical South Dakota political hires. They were from out of state. Typically, in my experience, that a lot of the political hires that campaigns or offices hire are people who have been, kind of worked their way through the system within South Dakota. And certainly you've seen that with our chiefs of staff. But in terms of the communication side, it tells me that she's looking for somebody who is an outsider and who's a brawler with the media and not afraid to take on the media when they feel that the governor's office has been treated unfairly or news stories or whatever. And it tells me that they don't have necessarily faith within the homegrown stock of political operatives in this state that they can handle playing hardball with the media. So that's why that's where I see now that they're looking for out of state people to come in and handle that communication side of things.
So I have a question for both of you here, and that's the New York Times reporter whose name is going to slip my mind right now, but he was on the program talking about, Governor Noem's political future and from the outside looking in, what does it look like? And one of her weaknesses, he thought, was her inability to have a consistent chief of staff by her side long term so far that's giving her that consistent policy advice. And his opinion was that you can see that through some of her, what he would consider missteps in her communications. So when we look at her political future, whether it's within the state or beyond, does having an inside circle of a chief of staff or a communications director that she trusts and that who is going to stay with her long term, how important is that? Mike Card?
Well, I think it's tremendously important. And part of it is the congruence with Governor Noem's philosophy and plans and goals for the state, obviously as mediated by the legislature, but finding someone who can both, as Jonathan suggested, defend against what are perceived as unfair media attacks, as well as provide that guidance. You know, the paradox that seems to be apparent here is if you are not playing by South Dakota's political culture, which means you have to play nice. If you don't play nice, you'll be isolated somewhat from the media as best that the media can. They'll find other sources. Whenever there's a vacuum in politics, it gets filled. So we look for other sources. And as we've seen the turnover in the governor's, I believe Maggie Seidel was both the policy director and director of communications. This is just the communications director side. There's bound to be shifts that may not be as positive for the governor's future.
Mm. Ellis, any thoughts on that you want to expand on?
Yeah, I agree with Michael's and Michael what he said. Sometimes I think that your policy advisors, you want them to be kind of consistent people who can analyze what's happening, and compare that to maybe what's happened in the past. And give you a perfect example. I got a letter that George Cunningham sent to George McGovern in, I think, maybe 1979, 78, somewhere in that time period, saying, listen, George, you need to, if you're going to run for re-election again, you need to really focus on that and not the national spotlight. And George failed to really do that. And so, you know, so I think sometimes the politicians themselves can kind of get out of touch with what is really going on out there with people. And I think that having that steady policy advisor, you know, those people can kind of help with that consistent messaging and keep a political candidate kind of in line with what voters' expectations are.
Hmm. All right, let's talk about the State Tribal Relations Committee. Sean Bordeaux, who's been chair of the committee, has been talking about it really being disbanded. There's a lot of nuances here. So, Ellis, explain.
Well, yeah, the nuances. I mean, Representative Bordeaux was hoping to have yet another, I think, a final meeting. This is an interim committee that was, I believe, formed in the late 80s or early 90s during George Mikkelsen's governorship. But hoping to have one more meeting. Now, the nuance of some of this is that state law will change to currently the way that this interim committee it elects its own chairman or chairwoman, and the legal the change in law now requires that there'll be a co-chair, which would be appointed by the Speaker of the House and then the Senate pro tem. Anyway, so that's part of it. So Representative Bordeaux wanted to hold a meeting, and I think he wanted to elect a new chairman or to set aside some time to new chairman. I think from Representative Bordeaux's point of view that there are a number of big issues that his committee wanted to address in terms of, you know, unemployment benefits, things of that nature, how grants that were the COVID grants, how not a lot of them necessarily went to Indian reservation-owned businesses, things like that. From the perspective of, Senator Lee Schoenbeck and Spencer Gosch, Speaker of the House, Representative Bordeaux was sort of being recalcitrant and trying to get away around this new process that had been set in place or will be set in place for chair. The new chairs, and so they just said, no, you're not having the meeting, and here we are. And so they've suspended the committee until I think the new committee will be reformed, I believe, following July 1st when the new process goes into place for selecting chairs. But of course, there were some accusations of racism on both sides, and it's been a tense, I would say, with this particular committee going back into last year with COVID. And travel checkpoints. That committee also got sort of crosswise with the governor's office on that. So it's been an interesting last 9 months with this committee.
Yeah, Mike Card. Final thoughts, because certainly Governor Noem has not had strong relations with tribal communities thus far, in spite of several efforts that she would say have been made and are positive. It does seem like on the that there's been some lost opportunities.
Well, there certainly have been lost opportunities to work together. You know, there are several reservations, lands reserved for tribal nations in exchange for ceding land to the federal government to pursue homesteading throughout our territory and then state's history. The efforts to build a pipeline across the state, both in North Dakota and here in South Dakota, have been largely opposed by tribal governments and their elected officials due to fear of water contamination and other health benefits health costs that they saw arising. You know, I think there's one other aspect to think about this is if you're the Speaker of the House and the President pro tem, you're looking at managing the legislature, and if you're acting out of line with the legislature, you may want to take action to reduce that. And, you know, this is what any manager does. You know, I certainly can't speak for the president of the University of South Dakota or the university or the Board of Regents, and I don't claim to ever do so. But if I'm a committee and I'm asking the governor to make a special session of the legislature that hasn't been vetted by the Speaker of the House or the interim management committee of the legislature, I should almost expect that they're not going to fully cooperate with me. And with the new law going into effect on July 1st, that sets who sets the committee chair and vice chair. It was just as easy for a June meeting that may not have the same membership of the committee. You would stop that process from happening by suspending the committee, appointing the new chairs, and after July 1st, they go forward with that.
Jonathan Ellis is a reporter and columnist for Argus Leader Media. You can find his work at argusleader.com. And Mike Card is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of South Dakota. Professor Card, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. A great day to both of you and the audience.
Jonathan Ellis, thanks as well.
Thanks, Lori and Mike.
Let's take a moment now to remember the Rapid City flood of 1972. The flash flood that hit Rapid City on June 9, 1972, was one of the worst floods in U.S. history. It killed 238 people and damaged or destroyed more than 1,300 homes. A huge thunderstorm dropped as much as 15 inches of rain in some areas of the Black Hills. The surge of water down Rapid Creek destroyed almost everything in its path. Some called the flood a wake-up call for the city as it reconsidered its floodplain development. Survivors struggle with memories of those days still. In 2017, we talked with Don Barnett. He was the 29-year-old mayor of Rapid City at the time of the disaster. He was a Vietnam veteran and the city's youngest mayor ever. He praised the courage of everyday Rapid City residents, municipal workers, and National Guardsmen as they banded together to respond to the crisis. Here he is talking about some of the successes and some of the devastating losses of that time.
All the time when we had these complex issues, I would just invite the council into our little conference room, and we'd hammer out a policy, and then we all spoke together. For every policy, Lori, I'm so proud of this, for every policy in recovery in Rapid City, we always had a vote of 11 to nothing. 10 councilmen and me, and I would tell the clerk to insert in the minutes the fact that the mayor totally supports this, and then the people had confidence in their government. We weren't a bunch of village idiots. We were doing the best that we could. We were cohesive, and based on the brilliance of the council, we really had remarkable policies for recovery, and that was the thrill of a lifetime. To see that happen, and all of us were not jealous of each other, and the cohesion between the mayor and the council was absolutely wonderful. And then since the flood, there's always these memories. I remember the mistakes we've made. I wake up in the middle of the night, and I remember how the National Guard was trying to get this lady out of a cottonwood tree, and they were trying to get a rowboat under her so that she could drop into the boat. And the National Guardsmen were so brave, and there was a lightning bolt and a crack of thunder that would just be deafening, and the lady fell out of the tree before we could save her. And I hear that sploosh when her body fell into the creek. I heard that sploosh in my dreams for 20 years.
That's Don Barnett. He was mayor of Rapid City during the June flood of 1972. We spoke with Barnett as he was working on his memoirs in 2017. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Robin Young. A new writing project for frontline workers pairs them with professionals to help them express the traumas of treating COVID through prose.
My gloved hand resting on a naked forearm in a meager attempt to bridge the chasm of the boundaries of our communication, trying to say it's going to be okay.
Next time, here and now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. First Dakota National Bank celebrates individuals and businesses with a passion to turn their dreams into South Dakota firsts. Learn more at firstdakota.com/first.
On the next Fresh Air, historian Jeff Schessel recalls the early years of the U.S. space program, when American rockets blew up in test flights while Soviet satellites and cosmonauts soared through the heavens. He also details conflicts among America's first astronauts, in part over their personal conduct. His new book is called Mercury Rising. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, 1 Mountain on SDPB.
Start your day with credible news and information from NPR and SDPB. Join host John Wynn for Morning Edition, weekdays on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, summer road trips are about the journey as well as the destination. Today we talk about making that journey safely in South Dakota. And for that, we welcome South Dakota Highway Patrol Major Rob Weinmeister. Major, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
So this is one of those standard conversations we have every year, but people need a few reminders, especially if you're from out of state and you see that 80-mile speed limit and think, let's go for it. So where do you want to begin with some of the important reminders for summer travel safety?
Well, I think the big thing for summer is, just like you said, that people are getting out. There's more people out on the roadway during the summer, and so it's just a good reminder to really take our time and focus on what we're doing, which is driving.
All right. Put down the phones. What are the laws in the state about texting and driving or being on your cell phone as you drive?
Well, you shouldn't be on your cell phone while you're driving. That obviously distracts you from what your focus should be on. So it is a Class 2 misdemeanor to text and drive. I mean, you are allowed to dial and make phone calls and stuff like that, but we'd encourage you not to use your phone at all while you're driving.
Yeah. All right. How about seatbelts? That's the law as well. Click before you drive.
Absolutely. You know, we have been stressing seatbelts for a long time. I mean, seatbelts not only protect you if you are stopping suddenly or in a crash or anything like that, but keep you behind the wheel. They are so important, and we continue to stress to people to use it. And if our troopers see it and people are not buckled up, they will address it with a citation.
Let's talk about pulling over when someone is pulled over. Tell me a little bit about when you're on the road and you see somebody who has paused off the side, what our laws are and why they matter.
Yeah, in South Dakota, you know, if you have somebody who's pulled over along the side over on the road, we'll say on a four-lane road where there's two lanes going in the same direction, by law you're required to move over into that furthest left lane if they're on the right side, which they should be. And if it's a two-lane road where one lane each direction, you should slow down to 20 miles under whatever the posted speed limit is when you're going by. I think that's just a courtesy thing that we should be doing anyway, but it is part of our laws for the safety of the person that's pulled over there, whether they're fixing a tire or whatever, as well as for you as you're driving by. You don't know what's going to come darting out from behind that vehicle. So
yeah, you've seen a lot of, you know, with your work with the Highway Patrol, you see a lot of times the consequences of things that are ignored. It can be, it happens quickly. Tell us a little bit from personal experience what you know about how important this is to pay attention to at every moment.
Well, one of the things, you're driving down these roads, just like you said, if you're driving down the interstate, you know, at 80 miles an hour, I mean, you're covering a lot of ground. And there's a perception and reaction time prior to even your car responding to whatever input you give it. So the more that you're paying attention and focusing on your driving, the sooner you're going to recognize, you know, that threat or obstacle or whatever is going to be presented to yourself, the quicker you can react, the more time that you'll have to stop. You know, I guess an easy thing to example would be, you know, if a deer runs out at night, obviously you're not going to see it as soon because your headlights only go so far, and trying to react to that. If you see it further, obviously during the day, you know, we have less car deer crashes during the day just because you can see it, perceive it, and react. And so anytime you're distracted from focusing on your driving there, you're decreasing the amount of time that you can receive a threat and react to it.
Deer, mountain lions, bear now. You never know. Yeah. So slow down because you might miss something really great, too.
Right. You might
see one of those black bears or some really great roadside attractions. And I'll throw in my my dad always used to tell me, if you slow down, you save gas money. So you actually get there faster because you don't have to stop to fill up so often. And it'll be cheaper. There's the thrifty tip from our fathers. And never let your gas tank go below half is what he used to say, too.
Yep, there's a lot of truth to that, and I think a lot of people, you know, follow that rule, especially in the winter. But it should be no different in the summer. We frequently still see people that run out of gas and are one of those people that we see alongside the road that we would want to move over for.
Perfect ending. Highway Patrol Major Rob Weinmeister, thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You can find more highway safety tips online at drivesafesd.com. Now live music returns to stages across South Dakota this summer, including at the Sioux Falls Levitt Shell. But music is about more than the onstage performance. It's also about community. Apollonia Davalos is producer, writer, and host for a new program called Music Matters. It's a digital series from South Dakota Public Broadcasting and Levitt at the Falls. And she's here in the Kirby Family Studio at SDPB's Sioux Falls Studio. I'm so happy to see you again. Welcome back.
Thank you. I am so honored to be here and to be a part of this collaboration with SDPB and the Levitt Shell Sioux Falls. Live music is back. Community, it is time to come together, celebrate life, and all that this community has to offer. I love Sioux Falls so very much.
We have missed it so much. We sit, this studio that we're sitting in, we can see Levitt at the Falls through there, and it's so great when the music starts on those nights to see the people starting to gather. Tell me a little bit about Music Matters, because the music starts this weekend, and you're going to be there.
Oh, yes. So first and foremost, everyone, please come out. We kick off this Friday, June 11th. The lawn opens at 6 p.m. Our opener 6:30, and then our headliner to follow, which is going to be Rinky Tanky from Charleston, South Carolina. So it's 6 o'clock. Music Matters. We're out there to meet you. A part of this project, yes, it's in-depth interviews with the music artists and how their vocation extends beyond the music itself. But we also want to incorporate our community voice, right? Your voice, listeners, people here in Sioux Falls, people here who live in all of South Dakota and beyond. I know people are going to be traveling from out of state to engage in the experience that is right here in the Midwest. And so we want to hear your voice as to why music matters to you. The program itself is going to kind of address the how, you know, the substance behind how music is created, and also the why, to accentuate that purpose. And here we are the epicenter of culture, community, connectivity, creation, and we want to bring that to life. So we want our wonderful community to come out. We're going to ask you several questions to kind of start. Each episode is going to be unique, individual to the artist itself and around their platform, around their mission. And also music is service, right? And so how they use that to give back to their community. So we will be addressing and highlighting mentorship programs, nonprofit organizations, those type of partnerships. And if you really want to get involved, these episodes are a way to find out how. What is here? How can you fulfill your mission and purpose in line with the music and all the things that you love? So we really want people to come out this Friday at 6 p.m. I'll be out there, and we want to ask you several questions. First, your name. Where are you from? Why does music matter to you? And if you could put it in one word, what would that be? And, of course, we want to shower out some love for the Levitt, who is giving us this opportunity to come together as a community.
And I want to add this, because one of the things that we do on this show a lot is we really think, you know, earlier in the show we had an election in Clay County about their jail. Now we're talking about a concert that is in Sioux Falls. But this concert is not just in Sioux Falls, because it's also the digital offering. And Levitt at the Falls has done such a great job during the pandemic with Levitt in your living room to really reach out. But talk a little bit about, if you're in a small town in a rural part of South Dakota and you tune into this digital series, you can start asking yourself questions about how music matters in your own community and kind of get some of these questions that you could really model some of these conversations. Talk a little bit about that synergy that happens you know, from different parts of the state that resonates in ways that you might not ever know about, but you know for sure is happening.
Absolutely. Music is a universal language, right? It is personal, and it uplifts us in very different ways in different scenarios. You hear many stories and when people reach out to artists, hey, your music saved my life. Mm. Hey, your music, I play every day at our wedding. Not every day at our wedding, but at our wedding. That's our wedding dance. I was at the Toby Keith concert that was here at Sanford Center. Mm-hmm. And he, in response to his audience, he's, hey, I always hear that everyone plays this at their wedding. So this song's for you. And the crowd, roared. And there are music that where people find they use it to express their love for one another, when we ourselves cannot find the words. There's that song, and here's that playlist. When you see those dating movies from the 80s, and you just also, hey, I created a tape for you, not CDs, digital playlists. But there's also more to it. There's a saving grace that comes from music. That speaks to us, like you mentioned, out in the farm in a small town community, what that work ethic is like. And music in and of itself is an expression that really defines and identifies the day-to-day, the grind. Yeah. And so it really is, we get to learn, educate ourselves from all the different professions that we have and that we carry out. There's so many. And I feel like music expresses that, and we get to learn what that is all about.
Yeah, we are here.
We are here.
My daughter, when I first took her to college, she played music on the way. She was in charge of the, whatever we were going to hear. And then I tracked it all, and I created a playlist, go-to-college playlist, and I just saved it because there is something about, having a song at your wedding where you see, this is where my child's mind was when she was leaving home and arriving at this new place. And these are the playlists of our lives. When you're at a concert at the Levitt, you are there with someone probably, or you're there experiencing community in a new way. Mm-hmm. That's memorable forever.
Forever. Yeah. So you made this for your daughter. It's about, family too. The Levitt, what they're providing, and SDPB in our series, this is for everyone. All genres, all ages, and truly how even as a family, we need more family adventures that families can do together. So this is also wonderful opportunity to bring the whole family together, which is, what everything is built off of.
The concerts are free. Some food trucks. I have been. It is a great thing to experience. How are people going to find you in 15 seconds?
Oh, sure.
They're looking for you. Where do they go?
Oh, look, I'll be on the lawn. I have the microphone, camera. You can't miss me. I'll also probably be dancing, and I will shout your name. So you show up. I'll be there.
All right. Apollonia Davalos. The series is called Music Matters. She's going to be out there this weekend with the SDPB crew. And I just have to say, listening to you and Crystal Schoenbauer sort of plan this out in the studio here, I can't wait to see it. It's almost distracting in its energy and the creativity and the ideas that are popping between the two of you as we put all this together. So thank you for being here. We'll see you next time.